Well, Fabian and Ann, I want to thank you for putting this symposium together. I mean, I think as a discipline, we really needed this. We needed it now, or maybe we needed it a couple of years ago, but it's good, and I'm glad to be a part of it. I do want to acknowledge my co-author, Scott Morrell. He gets at least part of the blame for what's going to happen here. And I guess Scott and I approached this from the standpoint of really trying to help the group transition from more compartmentalized presentations to this discussion period, because we hope that this is the beginning of something, not the end of something. We are big science, though we are perceived as small science, exactly as Sylvie just indicated. And that misperception is getting more and more critical every day that goes by. And if it's going to change, guess who's going to have to change it? It's those of us in this room. That will have to be who changes it. Now, I do want to correct Sylvie. She did just give a marvelous presentation, but she sort of implied that I was going to talk about funding only. Well, we're going to touch on that, but that's towards the end. We're going to talk about framing issues first, because I think you have to do that before you start looking for funding alternatives. So let's go ahead and get started. I want to go back to Anne's introduction to begin with, because I think she talked about some of the challenges that are facing us. She talked about, as in the business we're in, we're supposed to help contribute to agricultural productivity and increasing productivity in the U.S. and globally. We have to deal with the issues associated with losses from our fields to the environment. I think it was Brad that mentioned that we are utilizing finite resources in agricultural systems, and part of stewardship is doing a better job as time passes with managing those resources. And then, of course, while we're doing all of the above, we've got to help maintain economic viability for the cropping systems that we're doing. Now, as we were getting into this symposium, I was sitting there for a while wondering, boy, should we keep soil testing or not? is this really worth working on? I think our clientele are the ones that are answering that question for us. They're saying, yeah, we need soil testing. We need it to be working. All we have to do is look at this kind of our best estimate of what the quantity of sampling looks like, and you'll notice that bump in the last 5 years. It certainly does look like there's growing demand. Jerry alluded to this during his comments as well. We are going to see, I think, for some time, additional soil testing. So it's a worthy thing to do, what we're trying to do here today, and I hope in continuing dialogue and action as we proceed. Well, as we anticipated what would be talked about in these papers that we just listened to, and kind of reading between the lines in the abstracts a bit, it appeared to us that there were probably four, and remember, part of the assignment here was to define a framework, kind of frame the issues. And it looked like many of the issues that we just have talked about this afternoon would fit into four categories. You see them here. The changing needs of our clientele, traceability and accessibility of the recommendation process, looking at defining the appropriate context for soil testing with other practices that support nutrient decisions. And then finally, the critical mass issue of expertise. It's not just funding people. It's expertise, physical resources, and yes, funding to help with the whole process to address the several issues that we've been talking about. Okay, so let's then delve into each of those categories a bit. First, in the changing needs of our clientele group. Belief, this was mentioned early on in our discussion this afternoon, belief that advances in crop genetics and crop culture have altered basic soil fertility needs. And, we carefully selected the word there. That is belief. I'm not sure that has demonstrated yet, partly because it's challenging to detect such a difference considering the signal-to-noise ratio that exists in this tool that we're trying to develop. And so if it's not detectable, then what do we do with this belief of our clientele? Expressing the uncertainty of soil test-based recommendations. That came up time and time again this afternoon. I mean, there is uncertainty, and yet our tradition has been to provide what? Point estimates, single numbers. And Jerry, I heard you asking for single numbers and single procedures, but that's not the way this tool works. There's a huge uncertainty about that, each of those point estimates. And so the question becomes, how do we honestly present that kind of a number from the standpoint of how we best use it agronomically, and then how potential regulators are going to react to that? Like it or not, guys, your recommendations are becoming more and more regulatory. That's the direction we're heading. And so our challenge, I think, is to recognize that uncertainty in the way we deliver end products without destroying credibility, but rather building it in the tool because of the transparency that is part of the process. This was talked about several times. Building real-world economics into recommendation development that recognizes. Now, that recognizes some things that perhaps we didn't hear talked about earlier. How crops are marketed today, the volatility that exists in those markets, the sensitivity differences between highly responsive and marginally responsive areas demonstrate. And what we're getting at there is those areas that are most responsive, whether you're talking among fields or areas within fields, those are pretty much immune to market conditions. You're going to fertilize those very close to maximum yield regardless. It's those areas where you've got less responsiveness, those are the ones that are sensitive to market conditions. Have we got that built into any of our algorithms? I'm not sure I've seen that anywhere. And then residual value of nutrient additions. How do we build that into the system? Here's just an illustration. Looking at potash prices, dealing with this issue of real-world economics. All right, now look at that chart and say, all right, you know, up until that spike, build and maintenance was a pretty easy thing to swallow. But then we moved into a period where we say, oh, I think, you know, I'm going to look at sufficiency. And then all of a sudden the prices got high enough where what happened? Use just shut down. I mean, it was it. And those that had some buildup in the past, they were in a better position. So this kind of volatility is part of the real world our farmers are dealing with today. And we can look at the other end of the coin, the commodity prices. And if we just look at, you know, we talk about, you know, month to month or year to year. Well, here's just looking at days since October 15th in 2010. It's a 9 to 10% change in calculated economic optimum N rate in this case. We're switching from P and K to N, but you know, it does indicate that this issue of economic optimums maybe is not so much okay. Well, looking at a cost to price ratio at the time you're putting your table together, or the time an application is being made, because it's much more complicated than. And here's another aspect. Okay, this is a response model that Scott developed from some information out of Black's old textbook. Simple response surface, nitrogen rates, phosphorus rates on wheat grain, and then you look at, okay, the optimum level with a certain set of cost conditions is represented by the green dot. Well, it wasn't too long ago that we had people coming to us with questions like, well, I don't have $148 a hectare to spend. So then how do I spend it? And so if you've got a situation where you've got $75, where on that response curve is that red point? And as we interpret and as we create recommendations, can we make that kind of an adjustment for that person looking for the rec? Again, I've not seen too many recommendation systems that help a person find that kind of a point on there. And so appropriate allocation of limited fertilizer resources is part of this real-world economics. Integration of environmental applications into the recommendation process. We can separate in an academic environment like we are here the environmental impacts from the agronomic, but at some point they do get integrated in the field. I mean, there is a singular decision that gets made, And the challenge for us perhaps here is how we go about utilizing soil testing in a way that deals with environmental implications in that whole process. That deals with, and Doug, you mentioned all of these, the sampling protocols, analytical methods, interpretation methods. Those are all issues that do need to be resolved and that we could probably do a bit more streamlined process of in our routine systems. And soil carbon management. Jerry mentioned this. And I think he's right. This is going to, over time, grow in importance. And, of course, you know, we are dealing, the challenge here are the small differences over time we're talking about. And so I think there are some very special protocols that perhaps need to be implemented there to allow us to try to measure carbon sequestration. That is not going to be an easy task, but it's one that's on our table, like it or not. Okay, category two, traceability and accessibility. Now, this is not a new topic. And I heard a lot of what we were talking about today get into this. This is a cut out of a presentation I made in 1992. That, you know, it's kind of interesting to see how we look at PowerPoint today versus how we looked at PowerPoint in the 1990s. This was a cool slide at the time, but it's not so cool anymore. But the point, this was leading up to a little spreadsheet tool we call PKMan that actually does what, Dave, what you're doing very in a straightforward way at K-State now and what Brad was talking about, that lets the user indicate, well, what is your land tenure situation? Are you in a build and maintenance program? Are you sufficiency? And then it tried to predict critical soil test levels, that sort of thing. But anyway, the point here was that most of our programs were black box programs where you had a certain amount of inputs coming in one side and then a recommendation got spit out the other and a bunch of assumptions were inside. And we call that philosophy. But really, it's more than that, and I agree with Brad on that. And so what we're talking about here is turning a light on in that box and maybe let some others in, where you start trying to connect calibration data to the decision-making process. And this gets back to what Sylvie was just talking to us about, a collaborative process among researchers. And then one that's maybe a little scary, but capable of being tapped by users, right? Because the users become sort of what we could call a learning community in some of this, where they have their own data that may be capable of being merged with this calibration data. Listening, comparing, contrasting the algorithms. We've got committees that are looking at that with a precision ag focus, with a nitrogen focus right now. Maybe we need to extend that. Creating durable protocols for experimental design, analysis, reporting, data standards, cyber infrastructure. This gets back into what Sylvie just so eloquently talked to us about. And this is a slide that Scott developed a few years ago. Again, that is another way of showing what Sylvie was talking to us about sharing data, developing collaborative mechanism, doing things with it that are good things, and then using it to solve problems. And I would remind you that we can go out of our discipline here to the National Academy of Sciences, for instance. They have a booklet. I don't know how many have seen it, but it's a booklet designed for the young startup researcher that's just out of graduate school and you're just entering your profession. And they make a statement in here that I think is very relevant to us. They say, researchers have a responsibility to devise ways to share their data in the best ways possible. Repositories of astronomical images, protein sequences, archaeological data, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you could add soil test correlation and calibration data right in with that, I think. You know, they're telling us, in a broad way, one of our responsibilities as scientists in this small science that Sylvie mentioned. Okay, number three, appropriate context for soil testing with other practices supporting nutrient decisions. Sometimes I think we look at soil testing as a tool to do it all, to do more than it can. And when we do that, we end up with this knife off on the slide here that loses its ability to do much of anything because of all we're trying to do with a single tool. Right? And maybe we need to just recognize what the soil test can do, what it can't do, and then work to integrate the results of that test with other kinds of information, including weather data, climatic data, other spatially dependent kinds of information that we can do a much better job of integrating today than we could back when Truog first started thinking about how you test soils. More streamlined integration of plant-based information into soil test interpretation, especially where we know we have some serious limitations on conventional soil testing approaches. Other countries have gone a long way with this, specifically using QEFs. We've got countries that rely on DRIS a great deal. And, of course, here our emphasis has been on sensors. But are there approaches that take those plant-based looks at the system and that can be helpful in dealing with the limitations of soil testing? Can we integrate better? Those are the kinds of questions that are part of that issue. Soil testing as a supporting tool with 4R nutrient stewardship. Jerry mentioned this. The industry, speaking of the fertilizer industry now, and I think it's actually starting to expand into a lot of other areas. The concept of 4R nutrient stewardship is getting a lot of attention. Right source at the right rate, time, and place. And I think that the lesson here is that we need to recognize soil testing as a tool in that more holistic package. I'll get back to that in just a minute. And then also recognizing that part of that deals with contributing to performance measures and indicators. I mean, how do we know if we're getting the job done? And how do we know if we're doing a better job today than we did yesterday? Those kinds of things. And so it takes us back to this framework diagram that has the four R's, right source, right time, and place in the center. But in the background, you see the pillars of sustainability, and then around the outside, all those indicators of system performance. And so you think, all right, soil testing has a role to play in this. It's not everything, but it is a significant part of this kind of concept of stewardship that recognizes up front that it isn't just yield, it isn't just reducing nutrient losses. There are other factors involved as well, and it puts those right out in front. And right now there are a number of groups, of course, that are really wrestling with sets of performance indicators that make sense. There's a lot of work to be done there. We're just scratching the surface on how do we measure success in nutrient management. All right, and then the last one, the critical mass of expertise, physical resources, and funding to address major issues. A tough one. Tough one from a people perspective and a tough one from a dollar perspective. And honestly, you look around you and you don't see a lot of positive signs. This is a slide just indicating federal support, USDA, ARS, NEFA, R&D for USDA in general. What you see in the first column there is the change from FY10 to FY11. And that looked great. And then what of the end of September was being discussed or was existing in both House and Senate versions looking at the next year. And so that's federal. And you know better than I what's been happening in states or provinces to support for these kinds of applied sciences in general. And then you think of what Sylvie told us about being part of a perceived small science. How much of this are we going to get? Well, you know, it doesn't look terribly promising. And so what do we, in fact, well, and then here's another slide. I actually put this together a year ago from some work at Purdue that looks at number of graduates. This gets at the human resource. A few years ago, this room would have had a lot more people in it than it does now. And you can just think about, you know, the termination of programs in universities around the country. This has been talked about before. We've got fewer people, and the scariest part is to look around the room and recognize that there's a number of you in here that are not that far from retirement, and then you look at who's going to replace you and what kind of qualifications are they going to have. We've got some real serious needs there. Vern Cardwell in a private sector, public sector collaboration symposium on Wednesday is going to be getting into this in a lot more detail by looking at MS thesis and PhD dissertation counts over a number of years. And again, it doesn't look very encouraging. And so then what do we do? Do we just sit around and cry about how tough things are, or do we come up with a solution? And of course, what Scott and I are trying to do in this slide is really just to get us thinking about what might be possible and the kinds of things that might allow us to move ahead with these resource constraints. And Sylvie has actually already talked about a fair bit of this. It is in collaboration, we think. We think that is part of this. We've got to figure out how to get to that critical mass by combining efforts, by ignoring to the extent we can political boundaries, and thinking about the system more as what its properties tell us rather than what the political boundaries tell us. Multi-state structured around major natural resource areas. What we're talking about is perhaps a concept of nutrient stewardship centers. And again, these are just ideas, they're not well thought out, but where you have some larger entity that has the critical mass of people and resources and that will attract the funding. Physical, perhaps, or a hub serving of a network of existing entities that just brings problem definition to the table, and then also, of course, we are going after funding with this eventually. Both research and service mandates, perhaps. I think we have a soil testing sector that has service needs, and that's who I'm talking. I'm not necessarily talking about servicing farmer needs here, but serving the needs of those labs that do service farmer needs. Maybe a little bit of both. And so the commercial laboratory becomes both a partner in this and a client in this kind of a center. Regionalized data analysis, both production and environmental issues. We need to deal with these in I think, the same group. An interface then between scientists and potential funders, where you could see proposals that focus on major issues that are of interest to larger groups. I just went on the Science Policy Committee for SSSA, and we're told they're looking for reasons looking for things to sell in Washington, D.C. Well, I think we have a large science here, but we don't sell it very well. And maybe by looking at what these big problems are that we're facing with, that a lot of people are interested in, there is an opportunity for public funding that we have not been able to tap in the past. And then private industry, I may be speaking out of turn here a bit, but I think this kind of concept of looking at some sort of regionalization with cooperation in a larger way, cooperation rather than competition, that would be well received, I think, by a lot of organizations in industry. And there again, it opens up some funding opportunities. I'm going to quickly go through one more slide. This was kind of a bonus if I had time, if I've got another minute, because I think it's an interesting one, and it does relate to some of the other points that have been made here. This is a slide I built out of a proposal that was funded for some major funding on computer science and healthcare. Computer science and healthcare, all right? Remember, that's what this is. It involved defining a grand challenge. The grand challenge for this area was the development of a practical theory of medical diagnosis that is transparent and computationally tractable. Okay, sounds a little similar to what we were just talking about. The component challenges in healthcare: incomplete, uncertain, and changing information. Have we got that? Yeah, I think we've got that. Concerns of time, costs, and then safety. Yeah, we got at least two of those covered. Explosion of information. Think about precision ag and the data coming in. Yeah, I think we've got that covered. The need for process transparency in contrast to that black box that we were talking about and that we have done historically. Simultaneous diagnosis of multiple diseases. Insert multiple nutrients. All right, and so you've got that there. Desirable characteristics of medical diagnosis: a dynamic, real-time process that gives a probabilistic impression of disease, updated as findings become available. All right, letting farmers know about the probability of responses. I mean, it sounds like we wrote this stuff. And then look at this one. Potential solutions to the grand challenge. Extension of heuristic models using confirmation theory and Bayesian networks, extension of decision trees using fuzzy set theory, and use of a semantic web as a graphical framework of diagnosis. I have no clue what most of those words mean, but they sound awfully good. They sound exciting. And that's the whole point here, is that, you know, maybe we need to look at this differently. Maybe we need to come up with some new words. Maybe we need to present things a little better to help us deal with these issues that we think are important in a science that we think is very large, not very small. So I'm looking forward to the discussion. Like I said, we hope that this is the beginning of something, Fabian, rather than the end of just another symposium. We've got problems to solve, and I think we have some opportunities for solving them. So again, thanks for the time.